Alyssa Shapiro, Reel 4. Yes, can you cast your mind back to when you first heard the full extent of the Holocaust? Because after all, this is something you narrowly escaped, wasn't it?
I think I first became aware of, on a personal level, when my Berlin stepmother, who had been to Theresienstadt and had somehow survived, and she came to us in England. And she was the first one that told us. And Theresienstadt, as you know, was a very benign, relatively speaking, very, it was the show camp. So she had escaped with her life. But I have these funny little memories that we would be at dinner and my sister and I would do the washing up all this, and she would come out and she would take all the ingredients that were left on the plates. She'd had a proper meal, but she'd still, collect all these little remnants and stuff them down. And it took quite a long time until her eating pattern became rational again, and she knew she'd had enough. So that was the first personal encounter that I remember with a survivor. And but then, of course,
I expect you saw the films, did you? The newsreel?
Yes. And I'm vague now about what comes first, whether I first became aware with the general public and with bits of individual information, or through the Jewish Agency, because once I was there, of course, we had much more answers. The horror of it, the unbelievable horror, one couldn't really... I mean, I think it's not accidental that it took 40 years for people to begin to talk about it. Because I think it really is historically unique to industrialize human destruction. See, people have been murdered and killed thousands of years, goes on all the time. But to do it on this industrial, commercialized level, where you become a lampshade and a piece of soap. Where the whole process is, it is just unbelievable, unbelievable. I mean, to this day, when I work with the survivors and they go back, and they all live normal lives, yes, but they can't shed it, because it is, at some level, just unbelievable. I think of Rwanda, which is no better, yes, than all the hundreds of thousands that are being murdered. But it's just murder. There was this calculated, organized, Germanic, mechanized way of doing it, which is beyond anything that can be considered human, I think. And that, I think, when that began to filter through, it was just too big to take in, really, But it took in eventually, if you came through.
You are a counsellor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you probably know at the time, was there any counselling for the survivors?
And that is what many of them talk about now. But counselling didn't exist yet. When I first started in this profession in 1969-70, when we were back in England, it was a dirty name. I mean, to be on the couch, psychology, to talk about your feelings was... we remember that. It's only now that it's become really acceptable and understandable. They didn't talk.
And do you think they ought to have talked at the time, afterwards?
do you think?
I think so. Well, I have quite strong views, because now there is the sort of counselling of victim support, I think, has gone to a large extent over the top. That counsellors come in much too quickly. When the victims, I don't like the word victims, but what else can I use, are wanting it or not wanting it, immediately the counsellors are going to be briefly as it were. I think people have to be ready for it, but I think it is crucial when they are ready that they can offload without shame, and that people really want to, are able to listen, because so many of them felt that they were again, you see, marginalised. Nobody wanted to know. Nobody wanted to know. It's a bit like bereavement. You know, you find people cross the road and somebody's died because you don't know what to say to them. And it's very difficult for people to learn how to listen and just allow them to offload, yes, before you can begin any kind of therapeutic intervention. Just to allow it to be real, that this is true, you have gone through this, and it wasn't your fault. Because there is so much shame attached to it, you know. Because it was such a humiliating experience, and the shame of being passive, which I think has an awful lot to do with what's happening in Israel now, you know, that the pendulum has gone the other way, and we are aggressive, where aggression is not always the most helpful way of solving the situation, yes. Because never again are we going to be passive victims. We're all prepared to die, but we've got to die fighting. And this has become a kind of the mission statement, in an exaggerated, again, you know, you can't, I think these psychological waves happen, there's nothing we can do about it, it's a backlash. Like, the permissive society was a backlash to the Victorian age. I think, you know, all the aggression that is coming out now, it's part of all the passivity that went before.
Mm-hmm. When you talk to survivors, and obviously you know you have spoken to and heard a great many stories, was it all passive?
No, it wasn't all passive. No, it wasn't all passive. But by and large, you know about the ghetto rising, and you know about Auschwitz in the last days, yes. But there was very little they could do. I mean, the most active thing they could do is run against the wire. And occasionally you would kill one guy and you would obviously pay with your life. But nobody minded being killed. You see, they would all be very, who am I to talk? The few that I have spoken to, each and every one would have welcomed being shot. Just keenly shot, rather than, you know, to have to endure becoming an animal. So death wasn't really the most frightening thing in the camps. Death was very often, as you know from the expression Muselmann, the ones that gave up in a way, lost the will to live. Very understandable. But it wasn't all passive, but by and large it was passive. They had no arms, they couldn't organize. They were nothing. And they were skeletons. They had no strength.
Do you ever get the feeling that the survivors sort of discriminate within themselves different levels of suffering?
They do indeed. Yes, I think they do. And I think it's part of the human condition, I think, that somehow the more you have suffered, the more precious we become. I think it's a fallacious argument, I personally feel, and I really very often feel it my task to help them to get through that. That really suffering doesn't make you any better. And it doesn't deserve any medals either. But I think it's very understandable. And again, you know, I remember on a personal incident, when I was doing my training, my counseling training, I started off in what was then marriage guidance, and eventually was selected for tutor training, and I became a tutor. And during my tutor training, we had once a seminar on psychodrama, and there was one other girl who had been a hidden child. She had been, she was Polish, and she'd been in hiding, and she was then brought to the ghetto. And in this psychodrama, she chose me as her mother. And somehow, you know, I don't know whether you have any experience with psychodrama, but it becomes unbelievably real. Somehow this whole thing came out, which nobody knew about. And I remember afterwards how the whole group, who were all English, non-Jewish, awfully nice, good friends of mine, but we had become different. And everybody felt, oh, poor thing, poor you. And I felt this uncomfortable feeling that I was cashing in on suffering, you know. And I hated it. I hated it. I really, it's not a nice feeling that you somehow feel you're getting something through the back door because you have suffered, you know what I mean? And for me, this links very much, I think, with this idea of perhaps because their self-respect was so reduced, their self-image so non-existent by them, that only suffering somehow gave them an identity, you know? So I think there is a certain hierarchy of suffering, yes. And it's very understandable, but I don't think it's helpful.
Do you consider yourself a survivor of the Holocaust?
Not directly speaking. You see, I can't help comparing myself to this hierarchy. I haven't suffered in the same way, you know. I've gone through trauma, but I hadn't physically suffered. I was unbelievably lucky. I only consider myself a survivor in the sense that I am alive and the others are dead. And I don't know why I'm alive.
Hitler did affect your life very much, though, didn't it?
Much, yes. But I mean, there are levels of suffering. And when I think of survivors, I think of people who have been through the camps.
Do you think it's possible for anyone to understand their experience, you know, not having gone through it, to get a full understanding?
I don't know if one can ever get a full understanding of somebody else's psyche. There's a lovely Zen saying, you know, about one of them said, is either the lucky issues of his friendship and he says, can you feel my pain? And then he says, no. So how can we say, you feel with me the pain? Because we can't feel with pain. I think we can empathize, we can sympathize, and feel it. Which is part of the human isolation as well. Ultimately, every one of us is alone. But I think, you know, we can understand it sufficiently. At least I hoped one could understand it sufficiently to learn from it. It appears that one can't even do that because we're having a trouble. It's exactly the same. I mean, you know, the means are different, but what happened in Yugoslavia is, the ethnic cleansing is no different. Only the methods are different. And what happens in Africa is no different. So we can't even, and that's really a statement of despair. You know, that we can't even learn from it.
when you were in Israel, you know, the War of Independence in 1947-48, and those early years in Israel, was there a great deal of concern with the Holocaust, or did that come later?
You mean with the concern with individual suffering?
Yes, within the new state of Israel.
Well, I don't know how to define concern. I think we were too busy surviving ourselves. Yes, the war had to be fought. There were five Arab armies, and a nothing army in Israel. So, I mean, all the energy at that stage went into fighting the war, and into winning the war, and into integrating the ships that were coming in. And, I mean, one of the, I think, really unbelievable achievements of Israel is the absorption of this vast wave of immigrants. I mean, here what happens when 200 people want entry, you know, and it's a bill through Parliament, and can we afford it? And they'll take people's jobs away. You know, we've taken millions without question. And I think, you know, all the energy went into that rather than into in a way, the psychological side of understanding or, you know, counseling. Or, you know, they were taken in. They were housed, they were sheltered, they were given jobs, they were given clothes, they were given food, they became human again. And it was tough, because they will say that really, and again it's very subjective, because we can't feel other people's pain, they will say that really nobody had time for us. I'm sure that's true. Until later.
Well, you know, with your connections with the Jewish Agency, how important was it to get war criminals, the Nazis, to sort of hunt them and capture them? Was that a great priority?
I was no longer there then, because I left, I went to Israel in 48, and I was then, as I said, with the press until the end of the war. I then went to a kibbutz for a year, and I then joined the Air Force.
The Israeli Air Force?
The Israeli Air Force, yes, and I had different officers training, and I was no longer part of the Jewish Agency.
I was thinking, you know, in terms of reaction to the Holocaust, would the Eichmann trial have been an important sort of watershed?
Major. If you can honestly, it's major. It was a very cathartic experience, because it was at the Eichmann trial that the people's voices began to be heard. And in that sense, it was very much a watershed, you know, because it was then that slowly, slowly, the evidence came out, you know. And it's part of the shame, I think, of, in a way, humiliating, you know, the total humiliation of any survivor experience, that you are actually ashamed. And I think there is so much shame around. People couldn't speak out to us. But when they were actually confronted with this guy, that was a big thing.
So do you feel it's right to have Holocaust museums that people can actually go and see films and hear testimony about what happened?
I do, but I'm very cynical. You know, I do. I think it's very important, because deep down I still hope that maybe somebody, you know, some people will learn and politicians will not learn. And when it's politically inconvenient, they will ignore and history will repeat itself. But I think it is important. I think it is crucial that, you know, there are historical records of what I still maintain. And I feel, I have doubts about this sometimes, you know, sometimes I feel we're very, very different from the Armenians or from, you know, what happens constantly in history. But what was different was the means. And I think that is a blot on humanity, which which can never, never be wiped out. And it's incredible. I went back to Germany, you know, 3 years ago, especially to do an encounter group with Germans. It can never be blotted out on the German psyche any more than it can be blotted out on our psyche, and any more than it should be allowed to be blotted out on the world's psyche. You know, the world can know, and for the sake of its own political gains, not interfere. It's just so sad, isn't it? And it's what happens all the time.
How did you find your encounter groups in Germany? You know, how did you find people reacted? Were they wanting to to know? What sort of age were they?
This was a very special. There is the Reform, what is it, some Christians and Jews, the association. You know, there are a lot of bridges in there. I think it is very important for us Jews to understand the children of the new generation in Germany and what their shame is about, what they need to work out for their system, because they are not guilty. But they carry the guilt like the second generation of Holocaust survivors carry the shame. So, you know, both these national psyches, as it were, I think, have really been damaged.
It's interesting you're saying about the second generation of Holocaust survivors carrying the shame. Have you found that with your counselling?
Very much so. Very much so. There are many that I know who have nice red tongues and heroin and all sorts of suicides and a lot of things that are in the second generation. And again, there is this wall of silence. There was this wall of silence where parents couldn't speak and children couldn't ask. And now there are groups available. But it's interesting that within the groups, it's usually second generation and survivors, but not their parents.
Well, Elisa, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your wartime experiences and your reflections on this through your counselling work. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I hope it's been of service.